The U.S. Supreme Court rules in Aereo and Riley v. California. 23andMe in genomics. Harvard's Berkman Center teams up with Boston University on NSA surveillance legal authority and e-voting. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 48MN5, the weekly download of 48AM LLC. It's Monday, July 7th, and I'm Chris Bohm. It's been a busy 2 weeks since I last spoke to you, but first up, the U.S. Supreme Court typically makes the most of the month of June, when the race begins to the end of the month and term, and a number of long-awaited opinions are released. This year was no exception, but certainly a standout has been the court's unanimous opinion released on Wednesday, June 25th, in Riley v. California. In the case, the justices considered two cases in which police officers had confiscated and examined the content of cell phones of the men they arrested. In one case, the suspect's phone eventually led to an apartment search, where police found drugs and a gun, and in another, photos and video linked the suspect to a gang shooting. But in both cases, the suspect's attorneys claimed that police should have first sought a warrant before searching the cell phone, and that taking the electronic evidence violated their Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable search and seizure. Several court precedent cases had given law enforcement significant leeway to search things on or near a suspect, notes, wallets, photos, or other things in a suspect's pocket or within his reach. Law enforcement lawyers attempted to have mobile phones wrapped up under this broad authority for a warrantless search. To say simply that the justices unanimously disagreed would be an understatement. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the court's opinion, saying that when it comes to issues of privacy, and in this case, the need for a warrant, the difference between a wallet and a cell phone is as great as that between a ride on horseback and a flight to the moon. The many computers that we carry in our pockets can collect in one place the sum of an individual's private life, Justice Roberts wrote. The fact that new technology makes private life and the information about it portable renders it no less worthy of the protection for which the founders fought. A footnote in the opinion cautions against assuming too much with regard to the court's views on data collection under other circumstances. But the court also raised concerns Wednesday about giving police free access to information Americans store on remote servers in the cloud, such as with increasingly common web applications like Google Docs. According to experts cited by Craig Timberg of the Washington Post, the court's consensus on such issues seems to have grown over the past 2 years, a period begun by the revelations made by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. Legal protections for cloud-based information may prove to be another place where analogies to other legal norms, such as the context of the 1979 opinion in U.S. v. Maryland, may prove inadequate, as was suggested in a June 25th editorial in the Washington Post. Even the third-party doctrine, set down in Katz v. U.S., which says that users have no reasonable expectation of privacy when they share information with a company or other third party, could be set for a radical makeover. The strong wording used by Roberts throughout the opinion, the fact that it was unanimous, and the ties made to the thoughts of the Founding Fathers all suggest, to many legal scholars, that the opinion may not be only landmark, but also a portent of more to come from this court on past rulings used to justify modern surveillance tools and the coming fights over commercial and workplace privacy. By invoking language of the founders, said Supreme Court lawyer Tom Goldstein in an excellent article written by Massimo Calabresi in Time magazine, the justices seem to be embracing without limits a strong defense to maintain private space in the digital age. On Wednesday, June 25th, the U.S. Supreme Court also ruled against Aereo in a copyright case brought by the nation's major broadcasters. With Aereo, subscribers paid from $8 to $12 a month to rent a tiny antenna stored in a warehouse, which permitted them to stream almost live television and then to digitally record and store their chosen programming for major broadcasters. Aereo claimed this was a fair use of the broadcast signals. The court found otherwise, citing that the model constituted retransmission of the broadcast content, which required payment to the broadcasters, CBS and Fox among them, who had long been protective of fees required when such content is redistributed. There is a generation, primarily of young viewers, who are increasingly foregoing cable and satellite subscriptions in favor of online providers such as Netflix and Hulu. According to statistics published in the New York Times on June 29th, the number of households in the U.S. subscribing to paid television services has slipped in recent years to about 101 million households in the U.S. that subscribe to pay TV, down 7% from 2013, according to SNL Kagan. The number of households in the U.S. that use the internet or other streaming services instead of traditional TV to watch shows or movies has climbed to 7.6 million, up about 30% from 5.8 million in 2013. Some have cited the court's ruling in the Aereo case to be a significant drawback to innovation and particularly to cloud-based services. However, most agree that this would be a significantly overbroad interpretation of the court's holding. In fact, the court specifically said that questions involving cloud computing, DVRs, and other novel issues not before the court should await a case in which they are squarely presented. As attorney David Wittenstein told Ryan Fowler of the LA Times on June 30th, this is clearly not the last tech or business model that will come under scrutiny. People will always be innovating. But as Tom Giovannetti wrote in an editorial blog for the Institute for Policy Innovation this past week, to promote innovation and disruptive technologies is not to at the same time advocate get-out-of-jail-free cards. You must act within the law. Aereo was one of the largest net-based upstarts to gain a foothold among cord-cutting viewers, and although the court's ruling has at least temporarily halted its operations, the company did send around a notice to their subscribers that they are sorting out other possible options. Other providers range from Hulu, which broadcasters own, to bigger services like Amazon Prime, Google, and Netflix, all of which offer cheaper streaming alternatives. Other companies, including Roku, Sling Media, and TiVo, sell hardware that allows viewers to stream television to digital devices or watch web video on television sets. With Simple TV, users, unlike Aereo, buy their own antenna and the $199 Simple TV box. From there, users can record programs on a hard drive that they connect to the device. The company also sells a premium service that provides features like automatic recording and remote access from almost anywhere in the world. Mohu, a Raleigh, North Carolina startup, also has a similar model, and legal experts cite that unlike Aereo, users of these services own their own antennas and capture the broadcasting themselves. Whether the programming is stored by the user on a personal hard drive or to the cloud for their personal access is immaterial. Where you capture the signals and what you then do with it makes all the difference, the court was saying in the Aereo case. For genealogy enthusiasts, July will commence the second season of the hit television show Who Do You Think You Are, since the show moved from NBC to Lifetime Television in the U.S. A key programmatic tie-in for the show has been Ancestry.com, the online database of census and family record data compiled and made available by subscription. Another popular genealogy program has been Finding Your Roots, hosted by Henry Louis Gates Jr. for PBS, which will premiere its next season in late September. For Finding Your Roots, a key tie-in has been with the DNA testing concern 23andMe. At the close of many episodes, genealogy subjects will often learn more about their heritage from genetic markers analyzed through DNA testing by 23andMe, which can detail facts such as the percentage of Native American ancestry in your genetic profile. 23andMe customers mail a test tube containing their saliva to the company, which analyzes their DNA. As reported by Matthew Herper for Profile in Forbes in November of last year, 23andMe successfully had outlasted other genomic services to consumers, like DecodeMe and Navigenics, because the company presented itself not so much as a medical device, but as a fun way to learn more about genetics. However, that was not the long-term plan. Since last year, 23andMe's advertising has shifted gears to emphasize its services as a way to give people information about their health, and also to allow scientific research about genetics to proceed in a brand new way. With a large enough database of people who are sharing not only genetic information, but information about their health and their bodies, 23andMe was touting a tool that could be used to find new genetic connections, for detecting drug side effects, maybe even for finding new diagnostics or cures. By the close of last year, 23andMe's website specifically told the story of people who got test results related to breast cancer genes. 23andMe founder Ann Wojcicki has not been shy about the fact that this was part of the twin aim for the firm since its inception in 2006, to both empower users with genomic information about their bodies and also to enable further research. However, in November, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration ordered 23andMe to cease marketing of its personal genome service, in large part because the agency had not received any communication from the company since May, a silence of about 6 months. In the November letter, the FDA referenced 14 face-to-face meetings and telephone calls, hundreds of emails, and dozens of written communications, during which the agency said that it provided specific feedback on study protocols that would prove 23andMe's tests were useful as diagnostics, and other tests to prove that 23andMe kits gave consistent results. Instead, 23andMe began its expansion of how the test was used, and in January of 2013, the FDA said that the company had promised that it was doing extensive studies that would take months to complete, and then the promised data never materialized. In a terrific June 27th profile in the Washington Post, 23andMe's chief executive acknowledged that the company made mistakes, saying that it didn't fully understand the FDA's deadlines or the documents it wanted. In a blog post that appeared the day before the Post profile, Jeffrey Shuren, director of the FDA's Center for Devices and Radiological Health, said that while the FDA supports people's interests in having access to their genetic information, it must ensure the tests are accurate and that the information is not promoted as a substitute for medical advice. As commented in the Post article, the FDA regulatory apparatus has at times been characterized by tech entrepreneurs as a barrier to innovation. But as reported by Forbes' Matt Herper, it seemed at the close of last year that 23andMe was either deliberately trying to force a battle with the FDA or guilty of one of the worst regulatory strategies that Herper had seen in 13 years of covering the FDA. Regardless, as the Post profile points out, 23andMe's executives and experts are poised, perhaps more than any similar firm, to make a go of it and reach their goals. And according to founder executive Wyszynski, their regulatory attentiveness is back on track. Legal experts from Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society and from Boston University released a research paper in the final week of June on the vulnerability of U.S. citizens to NSA surveillance despite Fourth Amendment protections. The focus of the paper is on the collection of network traffic abroad, but also how American traffic can be and is often routed outside the U.S., sometimes only to come back to U.S.-based servers. And that, according to the study's authors, provides the possibility that vast amounts of U.S. citizen data can be taken up despite constitutional protections against warrantless searches. While the FISA court and its underlying law and the Patriot Act are well known and have existed for some time, the documents leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden show that the U.S. government has used secret and classified interpretations of these laws for wider intelligence gathering outside the bare language of the statute's text. In the paper, the researchers also cite the lesser-known Executive Order 12333, which the researchers say explicitly allows for international targeting of U.S. persons for surveillance when the FISA protections do not apply. This was apparently the authority used by the NSA to tap into the fiber cables of Google and Yahoo between their overseas data centers. The Internet, the report highlights, is widely known to route traffic via the quickest route possible and regardless of country borders, a fundamental of its operation. Although this is normal, the researchers caution that the data can be deliberately routed abroad by manipulating the Internet's core protocols, most notably the BGP, or Border Gateway Protocol, which not only determines how traffic is routed between individual networks, but is also often the entryway into national country networks. In this way, among others, traffic could be deliberately pushed outside of the U.S. or routed in such a way as to stretch the credibility of what might be considered an inadvertent collection of U.S. data under U.S. law. According to paper co-author Sharon Goldberg of Boston University's Computer Science Department, the fix has to come from the law, whereby the same laws that apply to internet traffic collected domestically should also apply to traffic that is collected abroad. The authors don't, however, speculate as to whether or not the loopholes in the law that they've identified are actively being exploited. There is no direct evidence yet, according to the researchers, to suggest that the NSA has exploited this loophole. Instead, the report's authors are aiming to, in their words, broaden understanding of the current legal framework, which, as it stands, opens the door for unrestrained spying capabilities. The report is presently available for download from the Berkman Center's website at Harvard University. In related news, the U.S. Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board said late on Tuesday, July 1st, in a pre-release of a forthcoming report, that it has seen no trace of illegitimate activity around information collected by the government under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or any attempt to intentionally circumvent legal limits. You may recall that in January of this year, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board released a report determining that the mass surveillance program carried on by the NSA was not only ineffective, but also had no basis in law. And further, the PCLOB had also found that the program never stopped even a single imminent terrorist attack. Given these findings, news of this most recent report proved somewhat shocking to the expectations of some lawmakers and civil rights groups this past week, in that it seemed quite contradictory. The report by the PCLOB is expected to make 10 recommendations aimed at arriving at a better balance between privacy, civil liberties, and national security in the context of applying Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Disclosures of U.S. overseas surveillance, including spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Brazil President Dilma Rousseff, have of course created considerable controversy abroad over the past 13 months. Some companies, like Microsoft and Cisco, have been vocal about the view that the surveillance is leading customers away from U.S. vendors of products and cloud services for fear of surveillance. Adding to these fears, the BBC reported on June 26th that the German government, citing NSA surveillance and related requirements made of U.S. tech, has canceled a contract with Verizon for provision of internet services to a number of German government departments. The current contract was due to run out in 2015. On June 30th, we learned that, for a week back in 2013, Facebook staff altered what appeared on the newsfeed of nearly 700,000 of its users. One group got a list of newsfeed items that favored mostly positive posts, while the other group got mostly negative items. As reported by National Public Radio's Aider Peralta, the research served to show that emotional contagion can happen online, not just face-to-face. The effects were reportedly significant, though modest, with users receiving negative postings showing that the effects of the mood change in what they persistently read and saw impacted their outlook and the negativity of their own subsequent postings and choice of phrasing. In the ensuing 2 weeks, much has been made of the lack of a specific line in Facebook's user agreement to prevent the study. As reported by National Public Radio, there's nothing in the policy about altering products like newsfeed, but users do agree to use of information for internal operations, data analytics, testing, research, and service improvement. However, in a follow-up report on June 30th, National Public Radio made the pronouncement that the internet is overwhelmingly outraged, with even the editor of Facebook's mood study commenting that it was creepy, according to Adrienne LaFrance of The Atlantic. Facebook's response to the fuss, as reported by Kashmir Hill of Forbes, has countered that a big part of the study was understanding how people respond to different types of content, whether it's positive or negative in tone, news from friends, or information from pages they follow. "We carefully consider what research we do," said Facebook, "and we have a strong internal review process. There is no unnecessary collection of people's data in connection with these research initiatives, and all data is stored securely." But, added Laurie Penny of The New Statesman, "I'm convinced that the Facebook team knows what it can do, but perhaps not what it is doing. If you are a locality and you set up a traffic exercise on the local highway that cuts down traffic to one lane, the ensuing backup will likely drive people to patronize your restaurants and businesses at the next exit. But that kind of mass social engineering rarely occurs, because the public outcry that often results can easily be a linchpin for unwanted action." National Public Radio's Scott Newman reported on June 27th that, after a 2-year trial, Norway has decided to pull the plug on internet voting. Norway had trialed online voting in elections in 2011 and 2013, but the country's Office of Modernization reported, in announcing the cancellation, that there was no indication that the service improved voter turnout. In addition, given political and voter fears regarding the initiative's security and potential to undermine democratic processes, there was no seeming upside to continuing the project. Norway's decision parallels in some respects the study undertaken by security experts in May of this year and profiled by the Guardian newspaper that took a dim view of security with one of the most successful e-voting experiments to date in Estonia. At present, according to the Guardian, up to a quarter of votes cast in Estonian parliamentary and municipal elections are cast online, and Estonia used its e-voting systems for European elections that occurred this past May. Trialed in 2002, Estonia's e-voting system has been in place since 2005, and the previous European parliamentary elections in 2009 took place with 15% of votes cast online in Estonia. As profiled by The Guardian's Charles Arthur on May 12th, security researchers took the Estonian system and recreated it in a laboratory environment. Although the Estonian system employs a number of security safeguards, including a combination of smart cards with built-in chips and smartphone verification to confirm votes, these proved insufficient to prevent against the attacks that were tried, including fake votes and hacking into vote-counting servers to install software that would alter the final count. David Jefferson, a computer scientist at Lawrence Livermore National Labs, wrote in 2011 that computer and network security experts are virtually unanimous in pointing out that online voting would be an exceedingly dangerous threat to the integrity of U.S. elections, as was reported by National Public Radio on June 27. Unlike security and related problems with e-commerce, where crimes can be overcome and fraud mitigation is often built in by industry as a cost of doing business, lost or fraudulent votes irreparably damage the process, implications that you cannot roll back. For further information and one possible source of more information on the realm of countries either trialing or attempting e-voting initiatives, see the ACE Electoral Knowledge Network at aceproject.org, established in 1998 as a project of the UNDESA, IDEA, and IFES. We rarely recommend an article or a paper that comes out without at least doing our own story on it, but this week we're going to make an exception. This past week's edition of Time magazine contains a 35-page cover feature on the smart home. The focus on the piece and all of its sections is on the user being conscious of what smart home innovations are, what your needs are as a user, and recognizing what you need to do to protect yourself in a connected environment. From the innovations profile to the problems with connectivity and hacking, the segments are all well written. And although unrelated, for somewhat comic contrast once you've read the Time magazine profile, pick up a copy of the June 13th article on Wired Online, written by Matt Honan, called The Nightmare on Connected Home Street. The article's tongue-in-cheek take on what can happen when you aren't conscious of your connected life, needs, and pitfalls is also worth a look. You have been listening to 40 AM and 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted this week from The Washington Post, Time Magazine, The New York Times, the Institute for Policy Innovation, Forbes, The Guardian, National Public Radio, and Wired. Thank you for listening. Next week, we'll begin a three-part series entitled The Role of Privacy in a Changing World, which will be an abbreviated sneak peek of an article I've written to be released this fall for the International Bar Association. 40 AM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, July 14th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.